Thanks for downloading Friday Night Comedy from BBC Radio 4. If you want to find out more, visit the Radio 4 website. But not before you listen to this week's Now Show.
Hello, I'm Steve Punce.
I'm Hugh Dennis.
With us are Marcus Brigstock, Nish Kumar, Pippa Evans and Mitch Benn. And this is...
The Now Show!
Thank you. So Tuesday marked something called Democracy Day, the 750th anniversary of what is regarded as the first Parliament called by Simon de Montfort in 1265.
We don't know what was discussed by the first Parliament, but we do know that they expressed a lot of anger that the official inquiry into the Viking invasions still hadn't been published after 500 years.
Now, of course, in reality, de Montfort was out to increase his own power and would subsequently be killed in what amounted to a civil war. All in all, although the media kept on calling it the first elected parliament, I very much doubt whether it was anything that we would remotely recognise as an election.
Hello, and we bid you welcome to Election 1265 as the results come in from ye shires and towns across the land. As the knights and burgesses are elected to Parliament. Well, let's go straight to the first result from Northamptonshire.
Sir Bedivere Mordaunt de Warenne Fitzwilliam.
Landed Norman Gentry, feudal overlord party.
14 votes. Sir Henry John Boris Pfeffel Michael Xavier James Blunt.
Bow down before your lord and master, ye starving peasants party.
12 votes. Osbert Ethelston Cedric Bloodaxe the Dauntless, Saxon Scourge of the Outlanders and Bane of the French.
UKIP.
3 votes. And I hereby declare that Bedivere Mordaunt de Warenne Fitzwilliam has died of the Black Death, and there shall now be a by-election.
Well, let's see what that would mean translated into a nationwide vote. So let's get a prediction from Mad Meg of Sidcup. Thank you, Mad Meg, one of the Treasury's best economic forecasters there. And I believe Jeremy can give us the swing.
Well, yes, this is very exciting because looking at his massive battle axe, Simon de Montfort needs a huge 120-degree swing to cut off the king's head. But all the indications are he won't get that much, and in order to push through his programme of epoch-making political change to monarchical authority, he may have to deal with Nicholas of Clegg, which is risky, of course. Clegg is very unpopular with apprentices. Now they have to pay for their own tuition. So, over now to Lewes, which is a major battleground for de Montfort, who has captured several opponents and taken them to the gallows. Yes, I thought so. That's looking like a hung parliament. Now, to be fair, that is an authentic 13th century joke.
That first parliament, though, it didn't last very long. Like a New Year's resolution to take up jogging, it ran from January to March and then stopped.
Yep. And it was the beginning of a 400-year struggle in which the monarchy fought like mad to avoid giving power to Westminster. I don't really know why they bothered, since nowadays the royal family has much higher public approval ratings than Parliament does. The royals came out of it all with a fantastic deal. Parliament gets all the responsibility, all the blame and all the hatred, and can lose their job every 5 years, while the royals get guaranteed jobs for life, free houses, endless trips abroad and masses of presents. But having relegated royalty to breeding and wearing nice hats for our entertainment, the serious business of governing lies with our democracy, which is why it arouses such passions. For example, who should be allowed to vote? In Britain, we oppose giving votes to prisoners, although other European countries do allow them to vote. In fact, in Italy, it's how some ex-prime ministers stay involved in politics.
But even if you can vote, does your vote make any difference? Or is direct action a more effective democratic tool? Earlier this week, the media reported an apparent victory for the power of protest when it was widely headlined that The Sun had dropped page 3 and moved it behind an online-only paywall. Shrewd move, given how notoriously difficult it is to find pictures of topless women anywhere on the internet.
Yes, but it turned out, confusingly, that nobody had bothered to check this with The Sun and that it wasn't actually true.
In fact, the whole breasts in public thing is confusing. So to help you out, it's time to play the hilarious panel game we like to call Have I Got Boobs For You?
Let's get straight on to the round we like to call Good Boobs, Bad Boobs. Now, we need our teams to tell us when the breasts are acceptable and when they're not. And we'll start with at a service in the Vatican.
Good boobs.
Is quite correct, yes. Pope Benedict said it's fine to breastfeed in church. What about in Claridge's Hotel?
Bad boobs.
That's right, put them away. Next, on Silent Witness, Ripper Street or True Detective.
Is it good boobs?
Yes, autopsy boobs, always artistically justified. Next, though, on Game of Thrones. Yes, man at the back with the box set.
Ooh, that'll be good boobs.
Yes, indeed. Sky Atlantic and BBC Four boobs, always acceptable. Next up, though, in American films.
Bad boobs.
Exploitative and unnecessary. How about in French films?
Good boobs.
Les boobs très bons. Yes, of course. Middle class arty boobs, positively healthy. Next, in Nuts magazine.
Bad boobs.
Obviously, in any pre-Raphaelite painting.
That is good boobs.
Of course, pre-20th century boobs, always acceptable. So that's the end of that round. We'll move on to the round we call Unacceptable Tits. We're going to show you pictures of four celebrities. Please just pick one. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mitch Benn.
Steady on, might be rubbish. This just in, from the increasingly cluttered UKIP bizarre policy statement desk, candidate Linton Yates, standing for the Charnwood constituency in Leicestershire, has issued a leaflet on which he pledges to ban from the roads not only cyclists, forcing them, quote, back to the pavements, but also benefit claimants. Yes, Mr. Yates would ban the unemployed from driving, thus ensuring they stay unemployed for the foreseeable future. Now, a UKIP spokesbeing, of course, immediately jumped on this and denied that these are UKIP policies, but you've got to say, this is happening a lot.
We're making it up. We're making it up as we go along. We're making it up. We're making it up as we go along. We don't know the words, although this is our marching song. We're making it up. We're making it up as we go along. We'll privatise the NHS.
Will we?
Won't we?
Dunno.
Yes, reverse defence cuts, surely.
No.
And bicycles?
Perhaps.
Dunno. We'll have a policy meeting and do what we do there. Just cut up bits of Daily Mail and throw them up in the air. We're making it up.
We're making it up.
We're making it up as we go along. We're making it up.
We're making it up.
We're making it up as we go along. Don't promise a thing.
Don't promise a thing.
And they can never prove you wrong. We're making it up.
We're making it up.
We're making up as we go along. Immigration! Immigration! This is our battle cry. Every day we shout it, but we never specify what we're gonna do about it. We're making it up!
We're making it up!
We're making it up as we go along. We're making it up!
We're making it up!
We're making up as we go along. We're keeping it vague.
We're keeping it vague.
We'll be in power before long. We're making it up!
We're making it up!
We're making it up as we go along. We're making it up!
We're making it up!
We're making it up as we go along! Are we?
I don't know.
Now, it's been a long time since Marcus Brigstock appeared on The Now Show, but he's been extremely busy preparing this next piece for us. So, with his special report on the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq War, please welcome Marcus Brigstock.
Thank you very much.
What's this? Is it a laser-guided smart missile? No. It's what deadlines sound like to Sir John Chilcot. Chilcot's approaching his report with all the enthusiasm and urgency of a goth on his way to a swimming gala. Now, I'm not sure exactly why Chilcot is taking as long as he is over this inquiry. My guess is Chilcot signed on to Netflix and he's in a Breaking Bad, Sons of Anarchy, Orange is the New Black spiral, and he'll pop out the other side in March when he tries to make sense of season two of Homeland. What? Why? Or it may be that making sense of all that happened leading up to the war in Iraq is complicated and nuanced and involves meticulous study of all the facts, and that inevitably takes as long as it takes, and it's more important to get at the truth than satisfy the demands of the mob. But that leaves me almost no room to speculate wildly and take the piss. So, I was very, very strongly against the 2003 war in Iraq. I mean, obviously, I feel pretty foolish about that now. Very naive of me to think that hubris, greed, religious conviction and misplaced patriotism would be in any way flawed motives for a massive, ill-prepared foreign conflict. I feel like an absolute chump. The main thing is, it's all fine now. And no,
the weapons of mass destruction that could make it to Britain in 45 minutes haven't been found yet. But they will be. They're probably under a thing or in a box with the Christmas decorations. Do you know where I think they'll be? They'll be in the last place you look. The point is, there's now democratic stability in the region, and where our tremendous freedom-bringing victory left off, Islamic State have picked up and run with a similar theme based more on murder, rape, enslavement, and the occasional reference to the Quran to make it all seem justifiable and important. It's quite probable that some version of Islamic State would have risen up anyway. As my grandmother always used to say, floaters will float in the end, for that is what floaters do. She was a wise woman, and she knew a floater when she saw one. But did the wild instability we helped to inflame in the region make Islamic State more likely and intense? Is the Pope a Catholic? Which, weirdly, has become quite a legitimate question. Now, part of the issue with the report is this thing where those it's critical of get a chance to respond before it's published.
So we therefore conclude that the basis for the war was false, the evidence supporting the conflict was too thin to be relied upon, and those who made the decisions should be held to account for their recklessness, and much of the bloodshed we have seen is their responsibility.
Right, OK. Now, put that bit in, the bit I wrote. Go on, do that bit.
But they didn't do anything wrong.
Yes.
And they were doing the best they could at the time, and anyway, it's all water under the bridge. And you don't know, man, you weren't there.
Yep. Yeah.
So, that all seems fine.
Look at the evidence, ask the questions, cross-examine the witnesses, publish the report, and then let them respond. Anything else looks like putting what's left of the cart before the smouldering stumps where the horse used to be before it was blown up and turned into Tesco Freedom Burgers. The cost of the inquiry was estimated at £2.3 million in 2010, which seems a lot, and then rose to £7.5 million in 2013 to more than £9 million now. I haven't seen a bill go up that quickly since my kids learned my login on iTunes and downloaded Mindbird's Angry Crash Flaps. Now, the Chilcot report has run into problems concerning how much of the correspondence between Bush and Blair at the time it is appropriate to publish now. To be honest, the correspondence I both want and expect to see are the letters that simply say, "Yo, Blair, we're going to war. You don't have to come, but Big Dick Cheney says if you don't, it's because you're a pussy and you love Saddam and he tried to kill my daddy. So are you coming to play soldiers with me or not? W, I'm the president."
George, hi. Yeah, look, I phoned God. Cherie had his mobile number, and, well, basically says it's fine. So, yeah, count us in. Yours, T. Blair, available for after-dinner speeches, corporate events, meet and greets, supermarket openings, book signings, mine or indeed anybody else's, pantos, selfies, late-night online premium rate chat rooms.
They're the letters we expect to see. Chilcot's will actually be the third inquiry related to the Iraq War. There was Butler, Hutton, and now Chilcot, and Peter Jackson has bought the rights and plans to make 9 very long and tedious films of all three where some CGI dwarves sing a song about dragons of mass destruction and Blair dresses as an elven king and gives a speech about how seriously he took the responsibility for his decision at the time. That one's called The Desolation of Smug. The Butler report did conclude that
more weight was placed on the intelligence than it could bear.
A bit like Russell Brand on Newsnight, then. It also said that
judgments had stretched available intelligence to the outer limits.
Which you'd think would be enough to discredit the whole thing. But they said from the start it wasn't about blame, so it was as pointless and baffling as an episode of Deal or No Deal. What's in the box? Saddam Hussein's head and a bit of oil. Hooray, we all win. And then there was the Hutton report, which, if I remember rightly, basically concluded that the war was mostly the BBC's responsibility, and anyway, it's mostly repeats and Downton's on ITV, and that's perfectly good. So in some months, when almost no one cares anymore, after the election, we will see a report from Chilcot, and it will be conclusive and thorough, and finally, the families of all those who died in the conflict will know exactly how it came about. And if that is not the case, we can always have another inquiry into this inquiry, and then another inquiry into that one, until we all disappear up our own sexy dossier. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Pippa Evans.
The best story by far this week was about a child being invoiced for missing a birthday party at his local dry ski slope. What a great idea!
Dear Jenny, I'm sorry you were ill last night. It must have affected your ability to write. Your text was just that little bit too late for me to unbuy that ribeye steak. So I'm sending you an invoice for £8.53. I hope that you feel better from Facebook, you seem to be. Dear Mum, yesterday you spoke at length to me about your choice of HRT. Though I have to go in my tone. You kept me 4 hours on the phone. So I'm sending you an invoice for £50, you see. It's less than my usual rate discount for family. To Daisy, who never buys a round but always lets me buy a round, then says, I didn't think we're doing rounds. We always do rounds. Of course it was a round. So I'm sending you an invoice for £97. If that seems unreasonable, Easter sorrows have been drowned. And David, this is an invoice for not one broken heart but two. Why did I keep going back to you? Who knew I'd keep going back to you? You wasted my time and my life. My Pizza Express vouchers. I'm sending you an invoice or death warrant if you will. If you don't have the money, your head can foot the bill. Dear all of you listed above, I send these invoices with love. Now pay up or this invoice I'll shove somewhere where the sun don't shine. And if you don't pay, I'll send a fine.
And now a man who says his greatest achievement was being Addiscombe Cricket Club's Clubman of the Year in 1996. Would you please welcome stand-up comedian Nish Kumar?
Yeah, it's true. That is my greatest achievement. Or it was, until I found out the criteria was the boy who'd shown the most enthusiasm in the face of, and I quote, an overwhelming lack of ability. So... this week saw the start of the World Economic Forum in Davos, where the leaders of the business and political worlds meet to discuss the most pressing issues facing us today. And top of the agenda was climate change, with Al Gore announcing a series of concerts designed to raise awareness of the issue. And, as if to highlight how low the awareness is, the delegates arrived in style with around 1,700 separate flights on private jets. Now... let me just say this. I understand that this is a group of busy and important people who have to get places as quickly as possible. But arriving at talks which involve the subject of climate change in a fleet of private jets is not so much a kick in the teeth as it is hiring Bruce Lee to roundhouse someone's whole head off. Switzerland also had to open an Air Force base for the first time to cope with these arrivals, meaning that the arrivals of these delegates has created a more serious situation for the Swiss than World War II. PricewaterhouseCoopers' 18th annual survey of CEOs was conducted this week to coincide with the forum. The purpose of the survey is to determine what issues CEOs feel are most pressing in advance of the summit. This year, the survey didn't include a single question about climate change. A spokesperson for PwC said that climate change did not make it into the top 19 risks CEOs were questioned about because of their lack of interest in the subject, after only 10% registered concern the previous year. The survey revealed that their main concerns were taxation and increased government regulation of their industries. Now, I am not the CEO of a massive corporation, and I've always been open about that. I think regulation and taxes are not as bad for business as having no planet to exist on. I'd say that it might dent your profits if everyone that you're selling to has been wiped out in a pollution-induced natural disaster. But let's be honest, even if that does happen, based on what we know about these people, they would probably still find a way to blame it on increased taxation and regulation. Imagine that the whole world has been ravaged by a huge flood caused by rising water levels. The last group of human survivors are huddled together, observing the devastation and fearing for their futures in this post-apocalyptic wasteland. And now imagine that one of those people is the CEO of a major corporation. Now, under those circumstances, is it really so much of a stretch to imagine the CEO turning to one of his fellow survivors and saying, "This never would have happened under Margaret Thatcher"? But they aren't the only ones. It's becoming increasingly apparent that a lot of the general public don't care about climate change either. It's starting to feel like the opening scene of a disaster movie where there's one nerdy scientist, like Jeff Goldblum in Independence Day, walking around going, "Oh, death is coming!" And the rest of the world is just responding, "Shut up, you square. Now I'm off to hack up the rainforest to make some tree hats before heading home for one of my famous crude oil baths." Now, I think the problem is that none of the words used to describe the phenomenon sound serious enough. Climate change sounds great, especially in the UK in January, when I frequently find myself thinking, well, I guess I won't be seeing my testicles until March. Someone comes up to me in the street tomorrow and says, do you fancy changing your climate? I think, that sounds great. Where do I sign up? And while we're on the subject, don't even get me started on global warming. Global warming doesn't sound like anything bad. It sounds like a company that only sells cocoa and hugs. But fear not, lucky for you, old Brainbox Kumar over here has been working away at the coalface, which, I admit, is an odd turn of phrase given the subject matter. I've come up with a list of possible new names for climate change that we could use to make people more concerned. And it could be anything like atmospheric turdpocalypse, Osama Wind Laden, literally a shitstorm, kicked in the weather balls, Hitler, and for our friends in the business community, increased regulation and taxation of oxygen. Thank you very much.
Now, while we were busy celebrating 750 years of democracy, the Oscar nominations came out and plunged everyone into an argument over meritocracy and whether a posh elite still really run everything. Not banking or parliament or law or anything trivial like that. No, the really important professions. Acting and pop singing.
Yes, now this was all kicked off by Labour's shadow arts minister, Chris Bryant, who said in the wake of Oscar nominations for The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything that there were too many privately educated people in the arts and that we...
Can't just have a culture dominated by Eddie Redmayne, James Blunt and that ilk.
Which I misheard at first and thought, what elk? Why has James Blunt got an elk? Anyway... I'm sure James Blunt was delighted and surprised by the news that he dominates British culture. I hadn't personally noticed that myself, although I do know that James Blunt changed his name from his real name of James Blount because he thought it sounded too posh.
You see, imagine changing your name to Blunt. I mean, imagine having a surname that was just an open goal for rhyming slang jokes. Yeah, but the point being, I didn't have a choice, right? But he did. I mean, he could have chosen anything.
Father, I'm very much afraid that when I go to school, the other boys will rag on me because my name is Blunt. I have decided to change my name, therefore, to James Blagina.
Now, I never thought I'd find myself saying this, but I think it all seems a bit rough on James Blunt. The whole basis of Chris Bryant's attack on him for being posh appears to be that James Blunt went to Harrow School, which charges £11,530 a term. Chris Bryant, on the other hand, went to... where was it again? Ah, Cheltenham College, £10,938 a term. Blunt then went to Bristol and Sandhurst. Bryant went to... Oxford. You see, it's a case of what at my school we used to call takes one to know one. James Blunt, though, was actually very forgiving. Asked what his message was for Chris Bryant, he said...
You're beautiful.
He didn't say that. He didn't say that. It's just so long since we've heard that on the show. But he was quite cross. He called Bryant a...
classist gimp.
Yeah, and they got into a big public fight. The papers described it as a...
posh spat.
Which is what James Blunt sometimes wears over his shoes, I believe.
Blunt, though, said that he couldn't get signed in Britain because of his posh voice, but he was signed in America, where apparently if you're talking about class...
They don't give a stuff about it, or even understand what you mean.
Oh, they do. They really do. They give a massive stuff about class in America when it comes to the British. They have very strong feelings about it. And those feelings are...
We love it!
Give us more posh people! Benedict Cumberbatch, that's the guy's name? Why, it sounds like some kind of antique wardrobe. I love it. Give us more.
Oh, give us more royal babies. And ladies in bonnets. More royal babies in bonnets. Oh, God.
But Labour's art spokesman wasn't just bothered by James Blunt. No, he used his private education to structure his criticism properly and back it up with evidence. He said that there...
need to be more working class actors.
Well, that's fair enough. That's perfectly true. What might help there is if governments hadn't discouraged drama and music as non-core subjects that don't count in the league tables. But we'll let that pass. He still wasn't finished, though. He also wanted...
gritty subject matter in drama to properly reflect contemporary Britain.
Yes, except as broadcasters consistently find, audiences don't necessarily want to watch dramas that reflect contemporary Britain because viewers want to escape from contemporary Britain. They watch Call the Midwife because they like to see a time when there were enough midwives. And they weren't having to work to rule for the first time in their history. See, if you want grit, there is a whole series about waiting times to see a doctor in Casualty.
24 hours in A&E. All in all, it was a bit of posturing electioneering nonsense. And although it is true that there happen, at the moment, to be two films about Oxbridge-type scientists, the British film industry has also produced Pride and Made in Dagenham, Vera Drake, Fish Tank, Neil by Mouth, Anything by Ken Loach, The Full Monty, Billy Elliot, about a million other working-class films, all of which have been conveniently forgotten in order to have a go at Eddie Redmayne and Smaug out of The Hobbit.
I wouldn't mind, but I didn't actually watch The Imitation Game for a while because I was put off by its name, by the title. Maybe it's my age, but I expected a completely different film and a completely different star.
Well, this is the moment of truth. Now we'll see if your theories really hold up.
If this works, it could bring this war to an end. It's a remarkable achievement. Ah, here it is. Well done, Turing.
Now, how are we getting on in The Imitation Game? Nice to decrypt you nice. Are we cracking the code? Are we cracking the code? Your 12 hours is almost up. They've got two of the three rotors. Didn't they do well? Now, it's not such an enigma. That was a joke. Ignore that. Let's have a look at the old scoreboard. His allies won. The Germans still. Marvellous.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So you may have seen, according to figures released this week, that the British now spend more on top wines than the French, which sounds like it's a bit of a guilty pleasure for us. And we've asked our audience, therefore, what they've spent more on than they know they should.
Duck liver pate. Why? Because I can.
I like this one. This is the only person in the audience who's taken this question philosophically. What do you spend more on than you know you should? Thoughts that are long and non-conclusive. Why? Because starting somewhere is necessary. What do you spend more on than you should? Cocaine! Why? It's very Moorish.
Legal fees. Why? Because of my bastard neighbours.
Thank you for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to The Now Show, starring Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Marcus Brigstock, Nish Kumar, Pippa Evans and Rich Benn. It was written by the cast with additional material from Sarah Morgan, Andy Walton, Matilda Wenick and Gabby Hutchison-Crouch. It was devised with Bill Dare and the producer was Joe Nunnery.
That was The Now Show from Friday Night Comedy on BBC Radio 4. If you've enjoyed this download, why not visit the Radio 4 website, where you'll find other programmes to download and keep forever, entirely free.